Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchak. Today we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland for a talk by Ambassador Douglas Silliman, president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. The title of today's talk is Iraq After ISIS, Caught Between the United States and Iran. Ambassador Silliman served as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq from 2016 to 2019 and U.S. Ambassador to Kuwait from 2014 to 2016. He retired from the Foreign Service in April 2019 after 35 years. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainpublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, president of the Mid-Coast Forum.
So I want to welcome you to the 431st meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Rockport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and the factors influencing them. We are now nearing the end of our 36th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we are very pleased to have with us Ambassador Douglas Silliman, who will be speaking on Iraq After ISIS, Caught Between the United States and Iran. Ambassador Douglas Silliman is president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He retired from the Foreign Service in April of 2019, just this year, after 35 years of service. He served as ambassador to Iraq from 2016 until earlier this year in 2019, and as U.S. ambassador to Kuwait from 2014 to 2016. From 2013 to 2014, he served as senior advisor in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs in the U.S. Department of State, working on Iraq issues and the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. Ambassador Silliman was deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, Iraq, from 2012 to 2013, minister counselor for political affairs in Baghdad from 2011 to 2012, and the deputy chief of mission in Ankara, Turkey, from 2008 to 2011. So he knows his way around the Middle East. His other State Department positions include Director of the Department of the State's Office of Southern European Affairs, Political Counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Jordan, and the Regional Officer for the Middle East in the Office of the Coordinator for Counterterrorism. In 2018, Ambassador Silliman received the Presidential Distinctive Service Award from President Donald J. Trump. He has received numerous awards from the Department of State, including the Secretary's Award for Public Outreach in 2007, as well as many senior performance awards. In addition to his position as president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, Ambassador Silliman serves on the Board of Advisors of the bilateral U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce. This organization helps American businesses expand their international business and trade ties, especially in the Middle East and Gulf region. Ambassador Silliman received a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science, summa cum laude, from Baylor University in Texas, where he was also a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He earned a Master's of Arts in International Relations from the George Washington University. He speaks frequent Arabic and French, and just as last month when I commented on this, from conversations with him, I believe he also speaks very fluent English. Doug, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
George, thank you very much for the introduction. And if you'll all permit me, I want to start with a story. So it's the middle of the night, and it's pitch black in the safe house. And the ISIS militant gets up, as he's been instructed, and goes to the window to see if it's dark outside, if the moon has gone below the horizon. Seeing that it had, he creeps to the door. He walks out carefully from the little collection of houses where the safe house is located and heads east across the desert, this undulating pancake of hardened dirt and dust. After walking a couple of kilometers, as he was told, he saw in the distance a larger village, and he remembers being told, you have to turn south, get away from that village, there's a police station there, you need to stay out of the way of the authorities. So he skirts around the edge of the village, and then he sees in the distance the main Baghdad-Mosul highway. And per his instructions, he turns to his right and walks south along that road for a couple of kilometers until he sees the road sign that says Baghdad 350 kilometers. Then he crawls on his hands and knees from his position a couple of hundred meters off the road right to the edge of the four-lane highway. And he waits there, as he was told, to see if anybody's going to come. So he waits 5 minutes, 10 minutes, he says, this is safe. So he starts to get up, and then he sees headlights and a car speeding along the highway past him. He pushes himself back down to the dust, his heart pounding because he felt he almost got caught. So now he's terrified. And he crawls back down into the ditch by the side of the road and waits 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. He says, what am I going to do? God, help me. I've got to get to my destination tonight. After 20 minutes, he decides, I guess the road is safe. So he gets up and crouches and runs as quickly as he could across the four-lane highway, dives into the brush in the ditch on the other side. And as he was told, he continues walking east a couple more kilometers. At that point, he can begin to smell the water of the Tigris River mixing with the dust from the desert. And he says, I've almost gotten to my destination. And then he sees in the shadow of the distance a stand of trees and some rocks, just that as he was told would be there, and he heads for that. And when he gets to that stand of trees, right on the edge of the Tigris River, he's met by two men. They very quietly say, welcome, brother. We're going to help you get across. So he said, but where's the boat? I have to get to that island. He said, well, there are no more boats because the Americans have eyes in the sky, and they can see the boats, and they shoot at us when we use boats. And there's patrols along both sides of the river by the Iraqi army and the counterterrorism service that look for slips where boats could stay, and they make it very difficult for us. So, brother, you're going to have to swim and float out to the island. So what they did is they gave him a plastic bag. He took off his clothes and his shoes, put them in the plastic bag, and they outfitted him with what can best be described as a vest, but it's really rope tied around a couple of empty bottles that are sealed closed so that he, who didn't know how to swim because he grew up in the middle of the desert, could float safely with the current of the river down to the island. But they said, brother, you have to wait because they can still see you if you're swimming. You've got to wait for some piece of debris or log or something to float down the river, and then you just float down the river with that debris. So he gingerly puts his toes into the mud at the edge of the river and then submerges himself. And he's shocked by the coldness of the water. Even though it's early in the morning, it's still 100 degrees outside. And the water is chilling, and he is virtually naked. He submerges into the water and then sits and waits for something to float down the river. So again, 5 minutes go by, 10 minutes go by, and then he sees this little clump of a branch with some leaves on it that floats by. He says, I can do this. He pushes out into the river, grabs a hold of the branches, holds his breath, and puts his head down, tries to swim to the center of the channel so he can get to the island. So he floats with half a kilometer down the river. He gets to the end of the island, and someone greets him and says, brother, welcome. You finally almost reached your destination, but we must dry you off, put on your clothes. So they march into the island, up to a clump of trees in the center, up a surprisingly large hill, he thinks, for the island. So after 10 minutes of walking, 15 minutes of walking, the man who met him said, brother, you're here. You can rest. And shows him a nice dry place between rocks with some tree covers. Now, this island in the Tigris River, about a quarter of the way between Mosul and Baghdad, is what many of us in the government and many in the press refer to as Hotel ISIS. It was a logistics base, a way station for ISIS militants who were transiting from Syria into the populated areas of Iraq, or transiting from Iraq back into Syria when they had another assignment, or when the pressure from the Iraqi army and the coalition was pushing them westward out of Iraq. And I mention this because the title of the talk that we had agreed upon a couple of months ago was Iraq After ISIS. But I have to say that on the 10th of September of 2019, the US Air Force dropped 80,000 pounds of munitions on this island. And after the fires went out and the temperature of the island went down, the Iraqi Counterterrorism Service stormed the island on boats to make sure that there was nobody left alive and ISIS could never again use this island as a way station. And most ironically, the closest Iraqi base that had American forces was less than 10 miles away from this location. I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about Iraq. I've spent a lot of time in Iraq, 5 of the last 10 years, but I don't want to look at the history of Iraq. I want to look at the issues that are going to affect the success of the American project in Iraq and the Iraqi project in Iraq as we go forward. And there are three issues I want to talk to you about and give you indicators that you can watch and judge on the success of that project as we go forward. The first one is ISIS, whether or not ISIS will come back. The second one is Iran and how Iran has been able to insinuate itself into much of what is done inside Iraq. The third is a very fast-growing youth population which feels it does not have opportunities that their parents and grandparents had. So let's start with ISIS. ISIS sped across the desert from Syria into Iraq in the summer of 2014, and the Iraqi army, and many other aspects, the Iraqi police just collapsed in the face of ISIS because they had believed the ISIS propaganda that ISIS was the caliphate built by God and that all the infidels who stood in their way would be destroyed. So in a couple of occasions, we heard the stories of the Iraqi army in an M1A1 Abrams main battle tank that was taken on by a white Toyota pickup truck with 5 guys with weapons in the back. And the tank crews, because they were so afraid of what they had heard from ISIS propaganda, simply abandoned their tanks and ran, where one shell could have taken out the entire ISIS raiding party. In this way, ISIS was able to move from Syria across northern Iraq and western Iraq virtually to the gates of Baghdad in less than 4 months. It was at that point, as they were nearing Baghdad, the Iranians came in. The Iranians helped provide some assistance to militias that they had previously formed in Iraq, and we'll talk more about that later. And the United States came in to help the Iraqi army stop ISIS at the gates of Baghdad and begin to push them back. Over the course of the next 3 years, the Iraqi army and Iraqi forces doing most of the work, little by little, village by village, kilometer by kilometer, pushed ISIS from Baghdad all the way back to the Syrian border. And then at the end of 2017, the Iraqi prime minister declared that the ISIS caliphate in Iraq was over. There were still many ISIS inside Syria, however, especially in the eastern part and the southeastern part, right along the border of Iraq. The policy that came out of this fight against ISIS in Iraq is very different than the policy that had driven U.S. forces in Iraq after 2003 up to the departure of U.S. forces in 2011. In 2007, there were 170,000 U.S. combat forces in Iraq, and there were 540 contract support personnel from the private sector supporting that 170,000 troops. The United States took more than 4,000 dead and more than 30,000 injured, especially in this period from 2006 to 2008 that we called the surge, to push back against the first radical uprising in Iraq that called itself Al-Qaeda. After the forces left in 2011, we restructured the way in which we dealt with the terrorist threat in Iraq. And it was something that the military calls by, with, and through. In other words, we will help attack the terrorist enemy using Iraqi forces trained and equipped and supported by American and coalition forces. And by contrast, in the 4 years of the battle against ISIS, from the gates of Baghdad through the western border being pushed into Syria, 14 coalition men and women, not all from the United States, were killed in the battle, not 4,000, but tens of thousands of Iraqi and Syrian military forces were killed. They did the real fighting. We dropped a lot of bombs on targets, but they were the ones who did the ground assault, took the territory, and defeated the caliphate as a government or proto-government that controlled territory. The problem is the ideology that lay behind ISIS has not yet been defeated. And the fact that we had to go in and destroy Hotel ISIS less than 2 months ago means that there are still parts of ISIS who are attempting to reform. And what is absolutely necessary is for forces allied with the United States and not American forces directly to continue to harass ISIS, make sure that they cannot go to ground, make sure that they cannot find places where more than three or four of them can get together regularly. This has to happen in Syria. This has to happen in northern Iraq and in western Iraq. And this has to happen in the big cities of Iraq as well. So one of my concerns is, given some of the recent decisions on the departure of American forces from Syria, I am hoping that we will be able to maintain the same kind of pressure on ISIS inside eastern Syria that did not happen in 2012 and 2013 when I was in Baghdad and we saw black flags waving across the border in Syria, but because it was across the international border, there wasn't much we could do about it. So the thing to watch now is going to be, does the Iraqi army, does the Iraqi counterterrorism service, do our Syrian allies, the Syrian Democratic Forces in Syria, have the support and the ability to continue to keep ISIS off balance so that they can maintain these small cells and maybe occasionally conduct an attack, but not organize and rise again to be a coherent organization that aims at governing territory. The second issue that's going to have a major impact on the future of Iraq is Iraq's relationship with Iran. And what happened after 2003 and the American intervention in Iraq is essentially that we decapitated Iraq. We took out the senior leadership, we dismantled the army, we took the top off the police department, we actually helped the Iraqis remove from power all of the people who had been senior members of the Ba'ath Party, the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party. These were all the people who ran the system, who knew how things worked, and while it was not unfair and they were beholden to Saddam Hussein, what we simply did is opened a huge amount of political space and a huge amount of economic space for people who we didn't really help much to move into. So what happened from 2003 onward was all of the various tribes and sects and groups and political parties and militias in Iraq began to elbow each other to try to find more space for their particular brand of politics, their particular racial or ethnic group, their particular religion, or their tribe. After U.S. forces left in 2011, we really left the field open. And during this time, especially in southern Iraq, the Iranians began to form groups that look an awful lot like Hezbollah in Lebanon, groups that come out of the Shia Islamic revolutionary ideology of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, on the pretext of protecting the unprotected Shia population of Iraq. So at first, this started to be small groups of men who were trained in arms, given some training, given small salaries, and really didn't do much but perhaps stand checkpoints and try to help secure certain areas. Over time, however, Iran has linked together these groups and has tried to use them as strategic assets inside Iraq. And in 2014, as I pointed out before, Iran and these now mostly Shia militias were one of the first sets of organizations that actually confronted ISIS militarily on the battlefield before the United States did. And that is something that is not widely known in the United States. And it is something for which Iraqis give Iran and give the Shia militias a great deal of credit. Because when the Iraqi army collapsed, when the Iraqi police collapsed, it was Shia militias and mostly Shia kids who volunteered based on the call of the religious leader Ayatollah Sistani to go to the front to protect Iraq from the threat of ISIS. It was only a couple of months later that the U.S. came in a big way to assist the Iraqi army and the counterterrorism services. This gave the Iranian supported and trained militias that they had been working on for the past dozen years or so political legitimacy. This gave them a great deal of credibility at home, and I remember traveling in the south of Iraq, and I think, Catherine, you remember this as well. Virtually everybody I visited, every family, had somebody who was serving as a volunteer or a soldier in one of these, what they were called the popular mobilization forces. And the ladies in villages would organize rotations of food and meals and support and care packages that they would literally put in the back of pickup trucks, and they'd be driven to the front to help supply these young men who had volunteered, even though underneath the banner of an Iranian-supported militia, to fight against ISIS. So what we have now is a situation where there is a great deal of legitimacy for these organizations because of the role that they played to defend Iraqis against the surge of ISIS against Baghdad. But the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration has now begun to shrink the amount of money that is available to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Iranian Quds Force, who are the main drivers of these pro-Iranian groups in Iraq, and has made it less possible for the Iranians to provide financial support to these organizations. Now, the Iranians have wanted to continue their connections to these organizations, but they haven't been able to provide the same amount of funding, so they have essentially told these groups, you're going to have to go find money for yourself to pay your salaries and do your training and buy your weapons and your ammunition. So what the groups have begun to do is turn into criminal organizations. You have seen a large amount of checkpoints appearing on roads where just average drivers and truck drivers are stopped and shaken down for small amounts of money. We had several shipments of USAID assistance going to help internally displaced people in camps in Iraq, which were attempted to be diverted by some of these militias, and we were able to put pressure on them and get the shipments back. But it has begun now, I think, to begin the delegitimization of some of these groups as they turn more political. The last thing that I want to say is during the period of 2010 to 2014, before ISIS came in the second administration of the Prime Minister named Nouri al-Maliki, he began very seriously to put his political supporters, many of whom are very pro-Iranian in their orientation, but not all of them, into positions in the middle levels of the bureaucracy and government. And what you have now in Iraq is a very entrenched and often pro-Iranian set of public servants who are beginning to link Iranian strategic goals with Iraqi strategic goals. This is very much at odds with the will of the population. We'll get to that in just a moment in the third section. But what the United States has been trying to do up to this point has not been particularly effective because we are expecting significant changes to Iraqi policy and pushback against Iran in too short a period of time. I can guarantee you that the United States is not equipped to challenge Iran on its battlefield in Iraq because we don't conduct assassinations or kidnappings, we don't bribe people, we don't pay independent militias, we don't try to maintain control of the groups that we have trained and supported to help the Iraqi people support themselves. The two things that the United States has that Iran does not have that we need to push are economic strength, investment, and private sector, and education, both of which Iraqis actually value very highly in their very long culture. but what has to happen over the course of the next decades and generations is a pushback where Iraqis begin to understand that Iran's relationship with Iraq is quite exploitative, and that Iran is using Iraq as its strategic depth in the face of international pressure. But unfortunately, the rhetoric of the Trump administration has made it more difficult for people like me to explain to Iraqis that the United States is trying to help Iraq. We're trying to build institutions and build an economy. And as we said in the title of the group, the title of the lecture, many Iraqis now see their situation as being stuck between Iranian pressure and American pressure.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Ambassador Douglas Silliman discussing Iraq after ISIS, caught between the United States and Iran.
The third thing I want to talk about is the new generation of Iraqi youth. 60% of Iraqis were born after 1990, so they know nothing about Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Just over 40% of Iraqis have been born since 2000, so they really don't know much of anything about Saddam Hussein. All that they know is that the government that was supposed to be democratic and help them build a life and an economy has not succeeded in that task. They have lived through an invasion by the United States and our allies. They lived through the fight against Al-Qaeda. They've lived through the fight against ISIS. And now they're living through, over the course of the past couple of years, an economy that is growing, but not growing at the rate that the population is growing. In 2018, more than 800,000 Iraqis graduated from high school or university, and the government was able to create 42,000 jobs in very specialized areas. This might not be a big deal in the United States, but in Iraq, the government has been expected, honestly, for 5,000 years since Sumeria, to provide most of the services that people need. Iraq is a wealthy country. Iraq has got oil. It has gas. It has water. It has arable land. It has a history of education. It's got very good educational institutions. And Iraqis are, by and large, very hardworking. So all of the ingredients are there for the Iraqi economy to grow and expand and provide a better well-being for its population. But historically, the Iraqi economy has been horribly mismanaged, and particularly over the past decade, the economy has been mismanaged. And I'd like to tell you a second story, which I think encapsulates what many young Iraqis are going through. This story was relayed to me in my first tour in Iraq almost a decade ago by one of the governors of one of the provinces of southern Iraq. And he heard this story because every week, like a good Arab leader, he opened his office for people to bring in their petitions to tell them about their problems and ask him for assistance. So he told me that one day during one of these sessions, a young man named Muhammad came to him and told him this story. "Mr. Governor, my father owned a car repair shop in a village in southern Iraq. We were the first of six almost identical shops on the row on the street. And then my father died when I was 17. I had to quit school and take over the business. But luckily, I was a better businessman than my father. And I repaired the cars better, and I got more customers. So when the man who owned the second shop in the row decided he was going to retire, and his sons did not want to take over the business, I negotiated with him, and I took over his repair stall. That was great. I was making a lot of money. I had a lot of new clients. And I was able to hire all of my cousins as mechanics. Life was good. In fact, I was making so much money, I was able to put some aside. And then I bought the third shop in a row from its owner. And I was in my early 20s, and I owned half of the car repair shops in my town. I could not believe my success. I was making money hand over fist, but I had run out of cousins. I didn't have any more mechanics. So I advertised for car mechanics. And that's when my problems began. So a few days after putting out the ad, a knock on his door, a representative of the local militia. "Muhammad, we are very happy that a local boy has been so successful in his business. It would be a shame if anything were to happen to your business. But we would like to help you protect it for only 10% of your profits." So, Mr. Governor, I paid them the money. Then a few weeks later, I got another knock at my door. It was the local director of the Ministry of Electricity. And he came in and said, "Muhammad, we are so happy for your success. I want to let you know that your father hadn't paid an electric bill for the past 34 years. Here are all the bills." He threw a stack of paper down on my desk and said, "I know you can't afford that much, but if you give me half, I'll take care of them for you." Then a couple weeks later, from the water ministry, from the city, saying that his shop was no longer under the code. "Mr. Governor, they took all my money. I have no business. I can't support my family. What am I supposed to do?" What this story illustrates is what those 800,000 young Iraqis who entered the labor force last year are learning. If they cannot get a government job, not only does the government stand in the way of their ability to create their own business and create wealth and jobs, the society has not supported it, and there are militias and criminal gangs that push back on them constantly. What you are reading about, if you've been reading over the past 5 weeks, is a series of demonstrations that has happened in Lebanon, but also now in Iraq, in Baghdad and neighborhoods and towns all the way south to the border of Iran and almost to the border of Kuwait, to the larger city of Basra. And what is interesting about these demonstrations, which are currently going on, this is the Shia majority heartland of Iraq. About 60% of Iraqis identify themselves as Shia. Some are tribal and live in the countryside. Some live in cities or small towns. But it's increasingly clear to them that the Shia-led government in Baghdad has been unable and in many ways is unwilling to open the economy to permit them to succeed. And what you have seen in the past month is tens of thousands of young Iraqis not identifying as Shia, as identifying as Iraqis who don't have any economic opportunities, protesting in the streets, calling for, first of all, services, electricity, water, and to some extent jobs. But as people in the security services fired on the crowd, killed more demonstrators, the calls for a larger reform of Iraq, including a change to the electoral system, a change of the government, a change in the way that the economy is run, are getting higher and higher. So I'm not quite sure where this is going to end, because I have been reading on my WhatsApp group with some of my friends in Iraq day to day what is actually happening on the ground. But Iraq may be going through, I guess, the echo of what we called the Arab Spring about 10 years ago in other parts of the Arab world. There is a large part of Arab youth in Iraq that now believe that the government and the system that is in place is not working for them. What is also interesting about these demonstrations is that almost nobody other than Shia youth are participating. In the Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad, they've been pretty quiet. In the Sunni areas of the west and the north, there have been very few demonstrations, a couple in solidarity for the larger demonstrations, but without a lot of real demands on their own. Among the Christian community or the Yazidi community, there have been editorials and speeches praising what the demonstrators are doing, but no upswell. And in the Kurdish region, frankly, the Kurds are focusing much more on what's going on next door in Syria than they are what is going on inside Iraq in the south. So what I find interesting about this is that many Shia believe that after the United States came into Iraq in 2003, we essentially brought Iraq back to its rightful place, a country that is majority Shia, run by Shia. And I think that the Shia have been particularly disturbed that the people that they have put in political leadership have absolutely and utterly failed to meet the demands of the people. The last thing I want to talk about is a little bit about what I'm doing now. I retired from the Foreign Service, as George said, about 6 months ago. And I've been very fortunate to land at the head of a small nonprofit that focuses narrowly and deeply on the events and the culture and the arts and the society of the Gulf states and the states around them that have great influence, Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and those countries that buy their oil, that invest in their economies, China, India, Europe, the United States. I'm infinitely fortunate to have this opportunity. And what I was going to tell all of you is if anything that I have said is interesting, I would ask you, if you're interested in reading more, to go to my organization's website. It's Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. I've got a bunch of cards here because it's a difficult acronym to remember. But it's www.agsiw.org. Because every week we publish three or four short papers, 1,000 to 1,500 words, on very interesting topics. If you want to know what has happened when Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, has lifted restrictions on women being able to get passports and travel without the permission of their husbands or brothers or sons or parents, we've written about it. If you want to hear or see a little bit more about sort of an objective rendering of the effect of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, we have written about that. If you want to hear about Iran's use of blockchain and cryptocurrencies to try to evade American sanctions, we've written about that. If you want to hear about what has happened with the attacks on Saudi Arabia or shipping in the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Sea, we've written about that. So all of these things which are now in the news, we have written about, and we have very good objective scholars who write factual reports. We try very hard to avoid editorializing, although we have editorialized by declaring that a war between the United States and Iran would not be a good thing. So we've gone way out on the limb on that one. What I meant to do today is not tell you that Iraq is going to be fine, that everything's good, that there is a solution, or rather, everything is going to fall apart. What I wanted to lay out for you is the three areas that I think the United States and interested Americans need to watch so we can evaluate whether our government, whether our allies, whether the Iraqi government are actually making progress. And again, we need to make sure that ISIS doesn't come back because it is a virulent ideology that has done truly horrific things in the region. We need to make sure that we are pushing back on Iran and Iran's influence in the region and in Iraq, but in a way that is effective, and I'm afraid that that's probably a long-term project. And then third, we need to watch what is going to happen to this large youth bulge in Iraq, because Iraq is a wealthy country, but it stifles entrepreneurship and it stifles the creativity of this very large and growing youth population. If that could be unleashed, Iraq will probably be all right. If the economy continues to be constrained and controlled by Baghdad, it's going to be much more difficult. So, gives you some food for thought.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Gives us a whole lot to think about. I always take, while we're collecting questions from the members and their guests, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question. It's the prerogative of the moderator. As I listened to what you're talking about, I heard a very unstable Iraq, that the political situation hasn't really settled down, that there's a lot of unrest among the youth, all of the things you've said. Is Iraq, how is it going to get to a stable situation where, for example, if I were want to invest in Iraq, I could be somewhat confident that my investment isn't just lost?
First of all, I have to say, George, it's a very good question because I have uncharacteristically painted a glass half empty picture of Iraq. As somebody who first went there in 2006 for a little while and then spent, as I said, five of the past 10 years there, I have seen great improvements in security. Iraq's oil production has gone up significantly. It's now the second largest oil producer in OPEC. They have, I think, the second or third largest reserves in OPEC, and they've done this mostly on their own without a lot of foreign assistance. Baghdad is now a safe city. There is nightlife. People are going out to restaurants. There are 5 or 6 big fancy malls in the city. You're increasingly seeing fancy cars driving around. So life in Baghdad and in most of the major cities had more or less returned to normal until about 6 weeks ago when these demonstrations started, and probably would have stayed fairly peaceful if early in the demonstrations there had not been deaths among the demonstrators, and the cause of the deaths is still a question of great debate. So I didn't want to say that there has not been progress in Iraq, but I think there has. Maybe more interestingly, and especially under young Iraqis, there is still a deep and abiding faith that democracy and the ability of people to choose their leaders, as long as they can find a system where those leaders are forced to account, is the way that Iraq should go in the future. And I was surprised that I heard that over and over again from all of the communities. And this is one of the chief demands that you find in the demands of these crowds. So even in the face of instability and economic problems, many in Iraq are not looking to rip down the whole system and start over again, but rather reform it in a way that will permit democracy and, to a lesser extent, a free market economy take over. So that's the glass half full interpretation. But I also recommended to George, and you'll see on the literature that you got when you were invited to this, there is an article by a woman at a RAND Corporation named Linda Robinson, who's a journalist and a researcher who has worked mostly on military issues. And she wrote in Foreign Affairs magazine, I think the September-October issue, one of the few glass-half-full articles that I have seen on Iraq in the past decade. And one of the reasons that I wanted you to read that as an introduction or perhaps as a follow-up to this talk is to understand that there really are opportunities and there are things that can happen to help ensure that Iraq turns out more stable, more prosperous, and hopefully more democratic and happier.
Thank you. Here's one on how the information we're getting from Iraq is handled. Do you feel the U.S. and international media have done a good job in covering developments in Iraq? Could you cite any examples of particularly good or bad reporting? Ooh. What about the information we're getting?
To be perfectly honest, there is so much going on in the world aside Iraq that the international parts of the newspapers, and I read every morning the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and go through a number of other websites, it's hard to find information on Iraq because it is crowded out, first of all, by the politics of Washington and the polarization of the United States, which is the largest piece of everybody's news. I am finding that I get much of my breaking news and a lot of my factual news from a WhatsApp group that I have with a bunch of friends who are currently in Europe, in Iraq, in different parts of Iraq. I like the WhatsApp group because somebody will say, someone just sent me this video of somebody shooting a protester in Tahrir Square in Baghdad, and somebody else will say, that's wrong, I saw that. That's Lebanon, I know that street in Lebanon, this happened 10 years ago, this is fake news. Or as happened this morning, there were other reports of the same thing. They said, oh my goodness, this looks real, this appears to be a legitimate act of violence by somebody against demonstrators just this morning. So it is, if you will, a self-regulating WhatsApp group in English and in Arabic where people try to get together and figure out what is happening in their own country, and I'm honored to actually be a part of that so that I can help evaluate it. But there are so many things, protests in Hong Kong, protests in Lebanon. I'm not even going to go through the whole list of things that are going that are being difficult in the world right now. It's hard to get good, objective information. And again, that's one of the reasons I suggested that everybody read the Linda Robinson piece in Foreign Affairs, because it was a calmer, more considered approach to Iraq in the face of all of the noise that we're hearing from other places. That doesn't really help you get good news, because I guess I could forward you some of my WhatsApp feed.
But part of it is what we should be reading or what range of things we should be reading to really learn more about what's going on. There were several questions here about the Iraqi Kurds and the situation there. In particular, what has been the impact of recent events in Syria on the Kurdish-Arab relations in Iraq? Has it affected separatist sentiments among the Kurds? What's happening up there in northern Iraq?
I purposely didn't address the Kurdish population in my remarks because I figured somebody would ask.
Several someones.
Yeah, there are, it's the one thing that I will say about Kurds in general is although they identify as the Kurds, in reality, it's a very divided group. They're divided by language, they're divided by national borders, they're divided by tribal affiliations. And there is a loose emotional tie among Kurds. But what has happened in Syria recently with the announcement by President Trump that the Turks would go into northeastern Syria to push the Kurds back from the border has triggered a very deep emotional response across northern Iraq, and I presume among Kurds in Syria and probably Iran and in Turkey as well, because there is beginning to be, according to some of my Kurdish friends, pressure from the population on the Iraqi Kurdish leadership to do more to help their brethren in eastern Syria. Now, already in northern Iraq, the Kurdistan Regional Government, the semi-autonomous part of the country run by the Kurds, is the largest supporter of both refugees, mostly from Syria and largely Kurds, and of internally displaced Iraqis, Christians, Yazidis, Sunnis, who were displaced by ISIS and have not yet gone home. So they bear a fairly large economic and social burden by hosting hundreds of thousands of refugees and internally displaced people on their territory. What concerns me the most is not necessarily a change in a desire by Kurds to move toward independence. I think that's probably that's been around for a long time and will probably continue until the Kurds actually achieve that. What concerns me is the Kurds' opinion of the United States and our ability to continue what has been a very close and very cooperative political, economic, and military relationship, at least the Kurds of northern Iraq. And even before I left, many Kurds were telling me that we're not entirely sure that the United States is as reliable as an ally as it used to be, and we're going to have to hedge our bets and do more with Iran and do more with Turkey to make sure that we stay safe. So I think that I think probably what the biggest result of the policy in northeastern Syria and the pullback of American forces and what the Kurds see as the abandonment of the Kurdish part of the Syrian Democratic Forces is going to be Kurds in Iraq and elsewhere in the region, hedging their bets and making sure that they have alliances and ties and connections to a broader range of people so that they will not have to rely solely on the United States for political or economic or military support.
Well, thank you very much. Okay.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Ambassador Douglas Silliman, president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He recently spoke with the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations on Iraq after ISIS, caught between the United States and Iran. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.